Good evening. Thank you and welcome to the National Press Club. I'm delighted to welcome you to the launch of John Edwards' new Lowy Institute paper, Reconstruction Australia After COVID, and really thrilled that you could all be here and glad to be able to give everybody a copy of the book. I want to begin by acknowledging the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging. Welcome everyone, and welcome in particular to two Lowy Institute board members who are with us this evening, Angus Houston and Joanna Hewitt. I'm Sam Roggeveen. I'm editor of the Lowy Institute paper series. Since 2014, the Lowy Institute has partnered with Penguin Random House Australia to produce our flagship publications, the Lowy Institute papers. This is a platform for discussing the big issues and the big ideas of our time, as well as the trends that will move the nation and that will move the world. John Edwards, in fact, wrote the first Penguin Lowy Institute paper in 2014 called Beyond the Boom, about Australia's economic prospects in the aftermath of the resources boom. And now he's produced the latest in the Lowy Institute paper series about Australia after COVID. Fittingly for the Lowy Institute, this is a book about Australia in the world. It's a story about globalisation, how it has fared during the pandemic, and its prospects in the aftermath. Soon we'll have an opportunity to talk to John about that subject and many others. And in a moment, I'll invite to the stage Lowy Institute Board Director Joanna Hewitt to launch John's book. That's going to be followed by some remarks from John himself, and then a conversation with John and Joanna, which I will moderate, and I'll be taking your questions as well. But first, I'm delighted to introduce Joanna Hewitt, whose career has spanned senior public sector roles in foreign policy, trade and agriculture, as well as corporate and public sector boards in Australia and internationally. She served as Secretary of the Australian Department of Agriculture, Deputy Secretary in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and as Australia's lead negotiator to the World Trade Organization, ambassador in Brussels, and APEC ambassador. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Joanna Hewitt.
Thanks very much, Sam, and I'm delighted to welcome you along this evening and to introduce Dr. John Edwards to launch his book here in Canberra. John, as you all know, is a hugely respected, not just economist, but economist, historian, writer, public policy advisor and company director. In this case, as Sam said, we're really introducing him as one of our senior fellows at the Lowy Institute. He's graced the Institute with some tremendously insightful commentary on Australian economic policy, as well as international economic and political issues, including the earlier Penguin special series book, Beyond the Boom. John might be remembered by many of you from his time here in Canberra as Principal Economic Advisor to Prime Minister Paul Keating. He's also been a financial sector economist with a string of corporate chief economist sort of titles to his name: Macquarie, Societe Generale, HSBC, economic journalist, again for a string of publications here and abroad, and board memberships including the Reserve Bank. If that weren't enough, John's also been awarded the 2018 Prime Minister's Prize for Literature for his excellent assessment in Volume 1 of his work on John Curtin's War. So he really is an enormous asset for the Institute and for public policy debate in Australia. In this new publication, Reconstruction Australia After COVID, Dr. Edwards brings the breadth of his economic, political and history experience to bear on what has been a confluence of challenges that Australia confronts. He focuses intently on the fact that we're going to be grappling with recovery from the COVID shock in a much less predictable regional and global environment. And he takes the reader on a pretty lively but deeply informed recap of what he calls Australia's long pre-COVID boom, liberalisation, growth in the Australian economy over three decades, closely associated with rapid globalisation. He tracks very clearly the parallel lift in Australia's integration into East Asian and Pacific markets, and especially with the opening of China, the dramatic boost we've seen to Australia's exports to the region. We all know that story, and yet every time you look at the data, they've moved further, and I find I'm constantly being surprised when I update. So at time of publication, John tells us that our exports to China are now a third of the total, and 10 times more than what we export to the US. He reminds us also, and this is important for what he wants to point to, China is now also the major trading partner of our other key Asian market partners, and the East Asia and Pacific economies as a group are intensely integrated, including Australia, but in the East Asia Pacific region, almost as much as the EU, according to the data, and far more integrated than the North American economies. He starts with a pandemic shock that temporarily reversed our long, globally fueled boom, and that coincided and probably aggravated rising tensions between the US and China. So that fact and the development by this point of deep disenchantment with globalization around the world, especially in advanced economies, has played into the way we think about what next. John takes a pretty clear-eyed focus on the scale of economic recovery the world faces, but for me as a reader anyway, left a reassuring sense that though the pandemic impacts are likely to be short-lived, absence of damage to the infrastructure, unemployment starting to come under control in most sectors, or better than that, and despite the huge burden of the loss of life, global growth, trade, and output recovery are already underway. We might come back later to the question that's in my mind about this generally positive outlook for Australia and for most of the advanced economies, but the picture may be a little different for many of the developing country neighbours and beyond. Perhaps the more anxious reflection in John's book concerns the heightened strategic competition between the US and China and our own deteriorating trade relationship with China. There's a clear focus on the risk that we could see a dip in opportunities if the largely open and vibrant regional economy we've experienced over three decades it falters. John, like a number of other Australian economist writers, and it's wonderful to have such people, has used the year of fewer face-to-face meetings to reflect and draw out some big questions. His suggestions for those charged with advising and taking decisions on Australia's post-recovery are there for you to read, and we're delighted, in fact, that there are a few of you here tonight to listen as well. Bold ideas, it seems, are emerging from a number of quarters about how to rebuild from the pandemic. Better, fairer, greener is some of the terminology we're seeing. I'm thinking particularly of what's coming out of Washington at the moment with the Biden administration's new approaches being trailed on taxation, social supports, regulation of the tech sector, climate initiatives and so on. And in the international financial institutions, there's also something of a sort of fresh set of ideas, fresh look at the experience post that of the global financial crisis to see what will replace the Washington consensus if, in fact, it's dead. So all these subjects attract tremendously keen interest in Australia and especially in Canberra. And it's my pleasure to thank John for what's a great contribution to debate at what I think we all understand is a pivotal moment. So we look forward to the conversation.
Thanks very much indeed, Joanna, for those remarks and such an insightful account of my book. So I want to say a few things more about it. I can't describe the whole book, but maybe a few of the points that I think are relevant to us today. I guess my starting point is that really for Australia, the pandemic is over. I think we've had one death in the last 5 months. We've had no serious community transmission for some months. Not as we expected, not as quickly as we expected, but vaccines are becoming available and you know, I guess we're still confident that most of us will be vaccinated by the end of this year. Well, the pandemic's pretty much over, but more precisely, for my purposes, the economic calamity is also over. We saw in today's employment figures for March that employment is now higher than it was in March last year. Hours worked are now higher. Participation in the workforce is now either matches what we had pre-pandemic or is a little higher, and it was very high then. It's possible that, probable, I think, given that employment has returned to where it was, that GDP is return to where it was or probably higher. We won't know till June, but my guess is that when we see the March quarter numbers, which for the period just ending, we will have had more output in a quarter than we have ever had. And finally, I guess I noticed that in the Australian Household Wealth series published by the Reserve Bank, our household wealth in the December quarter has never been higher, and by a considerable margin, about 10% higher than it was a year earlier. I must say I'd like to probe those numbers a bit. Well, it's not just us where the economic impact of the pandemic is fading. World merchandise trade in January was not just restored to the pre-pandemic level, but was running at the highest level ever, according to numbers produced by the Netherlands Central Bank. Global industrial production was never higher than it was in the 3 months to January. And on IMF projections, which came out just last week, global output this year will more than recover the loss in 2020, with the US growing at, according to the IMF, an absolutely phenomenal 6.4%, China 8.6%, and the world as a whole 6%. Well, that's where we stand. In some ways, what didn't happen during the pandemic is as important as what did. It was widely said during the pandemic, particularly April, May, June, that the challenge it presented to globalisation was insuperable, that it would crystallise all the tensions about globalisation, which Joanna mentioned, that had been building up prior to the pandemic. And what we discovered is that globalisation has not only survived, but it's flourished in those numbers on world trade. World trade never higher. World trade volumes highest ever. And an expectation on the part of the IMF that world trade this year will grow considerably faster than world output, which will be growing quite fast anyway. There was no notable increase in trade barriers during 2020, despite the expectation there would be, except briefly for certain medical items. Every year there are an average of 40 trade disputes notified to the WTO. Last year, 5. And despite the expectation of the contrary, also, no financial crises of any note. Indeed, the IMF makes a good point that the characteristic of the slump of 2020 was that there weren't financial crises, that the by contrast to 2008, for example, which was a financial crisis preceding a very long recession. And as a result, global output losses in 2008 were 3 times higher in half the time than the losses expected through the pandemic compared to forecasts. Well, finally, in my account of what didn't happen but was expected to happen, the US and China did not decouple. In fact, US merchandise exports to China rose 16% last year over 2019. That's not decoupling. Nor did the world decouple from China. China's exports increased by over 3% over the full year 2020 compared to 2019, at a time when world trade was collapsing. Foreign direct investment to China rose during 2020, again at a time when global foreign direct investment flows were collapsing. So there doesn't seem to be really much evidence that the US is decoupling from China, other than the areas of technology we're familiar with, or more importantly, that the rest of the world is decoupling from China. Indeed, it seems to be going the other way. Well, we do have some lingering problems or changes that I think are worth remarking. One is that despite the fact that we saw today that in March employment was higher than it had been in March 2020, we also saw that unemployment was 62,000 higher than it was in March 2020. So we have an unemployment problem. We haven't yet seen what the impact of removing JobKeeper will have on the number of unemployed. We'll see that next month and in May, this month and in May. But I notice that Treasury has estimated that 100,000 people, maybe 150,000 people who are dependent upon JobKeeper may lose their jobs. Not to say that they're going to be unemployed, they may find other jobs very quickly, but it's a risk that we'll have a big bump in unemployment in this month and next. And at the same time, the Reserve Bank has lowered our unemployment target well before the pandemic, but increasingly during the pandemic, the Reserve Bank has said, well, look, this 2.5% inflation target proves to be very hard to achieve. And the reason is that wages are not rising fast enough. This is what the Reserve Bank says. I think that's right. And they say wages won't rise fast enough to get inflation up to 2.5% until unemployment is lower than it was before the pandemic by a considerable margin. 4.5%, maybe less than 4.5% compared to 5.2% going into the pandemic. So that means we start off 62,000 jobs, 62,000 more unemployed in March than we had in March last year. We're going to add to it some number from of job losses from JobKeeper, and we've anyway changed the target to 4.5 rather than 5.2. So it looks like we've got a kind of a, you might say, jobs deficit of around about 250,000 jobs right now, or to get to our 4.5% target, or something like 2% of the workforce. Well, that's quite a considerable challenge. It's not one that we're going to be able to meet this year or next year. It's one that requires a great deal of concentration over a great many years. Well, that's one issue that's we're left with, unemployment. Another issue I think of more interest to people in Canberra perhaps than more widely is the probable big change in the role of Treasury. I think it was 38 years ago, the Australian dollar was floated. Prior to that, the value of the Australian dollar had been determined in a committee in which Treasury exercised most of the authority. Effectively, Treasury set the exchange rate and the Reserve Bank was compelled to achieve it and use its instruments to do so, leaving it very little chance of doing anything else. Well, that changed with the float. The Reserve Bank took control of day-to-day economic management using its monetary policy tools, and that's been the case for the last nearly four decades. Well, it's over for a while anyway. It's over because the Reserve Bank is fully stretched. Interest rates are as low as they're going to go. The bank has increased its balance sheet nearly four times, 3.6 times, buying bonds and other assets, Australian dollar assets. It's capped the five-year rate and it's influencing the 10-year bond rate and accordingly influencing the Australian dollar. But it's fully stretched. That's as much as it can do. Well, a way of illustrating the importance of that point is to remind ourselves of what happened after the 2008 financial crisis, when we had a similarly big response in the budget. That is, the budget went into deficit, I think, of around about 6% over 2 years. So there was no doubt fiscal policy was very important, but in the subsequent decade, that is, to in the 10 years to just prior to the pandemic, pretty well every year, not exactly every year, but pretty well every year, the government reduced the deficit, Labor then, Liberal, with a contractionary impact on the economy, as one would expect. And this was to a very large extent offset by the Reserve Bank. In 2011, the Reserve Bank cash rate was 4.75. 8 years later, it was 0.75. The dollar, the Australian dollar against the US dollar, had gone from buying $1.10 US to buying just 70 cents, become a lot cheaper. So the Reserve Bank was able to offset a contractionary monetary policy by an expansionary, fiscal policy by an expansionary monetary policy. Well, that option is no longer available. Going forward over the next decade, we will be highly likely reducing budget deficits, opportunistically perhaps, structurally perhaps, but it'll require very careful judgment because the responsibility for economic management is more clearly defined as being that of the Treasurer and Treasury, because the central bank now has no further capacity to follow an expansionary policy. Well, it'd be very interesting to see how Treasury handles that. It's going to raise a lot of sort of issues that we used to talk about years ago and haven't talked about for decades. You know, what's an expansionary, what's a flexible fiscal policy look like? What instruments do you use? For example, we used to say, well, it's difficult to use taxes because if you cut taxes, it's easier to cut them, but very hard to restore them to where they were. With fiscal policy, the distributive impact of any change you make is much more evident. So it's a political contest always over fiscal policy, which is obscured with equivalent policies pursued by the Reserve Bank, where you're just changing one instrument, interest rates, and in a kind of a rather distant fashion where people are not clearly aware of the distributive impact of the political impact. So we're going to go back into those kind of conversations. I think, in a way, those conversations are going to be more interesting than the than the other lingering legacy of the pandemic, which is a huge increase in federal government debt. The point was well made that prior to the pandemic, that so long as the interest rate on government debt is lower than the rate of growth, nominal rate of growth of the economy, then so long as you're controlling them, for any fixed level of debt, it'll decline as a share of GDP. One of the reasons for that is that tax revenue will go up by GDP, and if GDP is growing faster than the interest rate on debt, then revenue will be increasing faster than the obligation on the debt. So I'm not as troubled as some people will be by the enormous amount of debt we've taken on. It's, of course, much less than other advanced economies have had to take on in Europe, US, Japan. We can deal with it. We can deal with it over a long period. It's essential, I think, that we while managing it, manage it very prudently with a view to the impact on the economy as a whole. Well, I think those are some of the important things. I'm less distressed by the sharp decline in net migration, net permanent long-term migration, which will be with us for another year or two, precisely because we have such a big unemployment problem ourselves. I think even if immigration were available to us, it would be prudent for us to be following a much smaller program of net migration, given our unemployment problem, than we had prior to the pandemic. Well, a lot of... let me just conclude by reflecting a bit on where we come from. A lot of our... I noticed that a lot of our kind of thinking about where we go next seems to be based on a evaluation of where we came from, of how, what kind of circumstance we were in prior to the pandemic. And I guess I just want to make the point that it's perfectly true that the growth of output per head had slowed in the 10 years prior to the pandemic. The growth of output had slowed. It was still positive, very positive, but it had slowed compared to the previous 10 years. The growth of productivity was weak. That is, the growth of output per hour worked was weak, labour productivity, although it was weak most places, most advanced economies, and had been slowing for 20 years. In Australia throughout the 21st century. I'm inclined to think that the characterisation of the pre-pandemic Australian economy as a failing economy misinterprets what we had achieved, which I think was considerable, 29 years of without a recession. We ended up with a level of non-mining business investment higher than it had ever been, except in 2019, except for 2018. Even as the share of GDP, it was only just below a record level. In other words, we had reason to be pleased with the way things were going prior to the pandemic, and it doesn't trouble me very much if... the extent of our ambition is to get back to where we were. Thank you.
John, thank you, and welcome, Joe. Can I start by firstly acknowledging, John, what a speaking as the editor of this book and someone who's been working as an editor on and off for 15 years, what a pleasure it was to work with you on this. John, over 15 years I've worked with them all, and John was an absolute joy to work with as editor to author. So thank you, and I really appreciate it. Your remarks tonight as well. I want to leave a bit of as much time as possible for your questions, so please get them ready. There's a microphone in the middle there if you'd like to make your way there in a moment when I hand it over to you for your questions. But John, let me get things started with you first. Overall, what we heard tonight, and I think what we see in the book, is a generally optimistic picture about Australia's economic future, and indeed about the future of globalisation and the world economy. I just wonder, in particularly in the Australian perspective, whether your optimism has been dented at all by what is now generally regarded as the botched vaccine rollout. Is the delay in the program of full vaccination going to have any economic consequences? That's my first question. And then my second question is, does it at all dent your impression that of Australia's overall general good management of the pandemic crisis, economic management of the pandemic crisis?
Well, I think it would be vastly better if we had been better prepared, if we'd accumulated a stock earlier than we had, if we had a means of delivering it more widely and more aggressively than we have. So I don't think it helps. But on the other hand, it's true that we have practically no community transmission of COVID, even with the vaccine, it's not clear that we're going to be able to travel widely or invite people here unless they themselves have been vaccinated. So the reopening of travel, which is the big kind of economic consequence of vaccines, depends not just on us getting vaccinated, but the rest of the world getting vaccinated, so, or a large part of it. So I guess, Sam, I'm not convinced that it's a huge economic impact from the delay, but it certainly doesn't do the government any good.
And more broadly, does it dent your sense at all that the well, let me put it in terms of actually the language you used in your introductory remarks, where you talked about the role of the Reserve Bank and the Treasury and so on. That really puts the emphasis on bureaucratic structures, but there's of course the layer above that is political leadership, and my impression from the book is that you generally judge the level of political leadership over the last 12 months to have been pretty good also. Is Australia generally better led than most Australians think it is in economic terms? And does the do the events of the last few weeks cause you to reassess that judgment?
Well, it's a very interesting kind of question. To what extent is the political leadership of Australia how much credit does the political leadership of Australia deserve for our relatively good experience of the pandemic? And we'd need to know a little more than we do. You could say that, you know, the swift response of the Reserve Bank was somewhat separate from government. It certainly, you know, would have required the involvement of the Treasurer. The enormous fiscal response no doubt originated in Treasury, but on the other hand, it had to have the assent of the Treasurer and the Cabinet. So I think they deserve credit for this. And hitherto, in terms of the operation of our health system and of our health officials and of the importance of health science, we've done pretty well. So I would say the stumble over vaccination does seem to be more of a, you know, exception than a rule.
So, Joanna Hewitt, I'd like to ask you the same hand grenade of a question. Is Australia generally, drawing on your experience of seeing how government operates in various parts of the world, is Australia generally better led than its own citizens give it credit for? And does the response to COVID reinforce your judgment or undermine it?
Again, I find it also a bit hard to answer. I certainly internationally, Australia's economic management's held in pretty wide regard, high regard. We regularly see our treasurers appearing as finance minister of the year. And I think the sort of 30 years of growth and the evolution of diversification of the economy, notwithstanding John's point about the slowing productivity growth, although again, that's something that's common to many advanced countries. I mean, I think really we do have to give credit where it's due for the management of the crisis, including through the complications of a federal system. I think that, I mean, the Brits don't have that really as an excuse, but the Americans, their federation is slightly more state-centric in ways that matter for this purpose, but that seemed to be one of the confounding factors along with many others. As to the vaccination question, I mean, there's been some bad luck. Who could have anticipated the AstraZeneca story? And that, you know, there could be arguments about whether there should have been a more diverse range of options, and should have been mobilised more quickly, and the rollout perhaps multiple planked rather than focus as it has been in a local way. I think it's true that most Australians, and I think most Australians deep down accept that, even though we all grumble.
And let me stay with you, Joe, and just ask you whether you generally concur with John's optimism about the way that globalised trade has come through the pandemic, or is coming through. We should still speak in the present tense rather than the past.
I think I'm possibly a little more cautious. I noted your reference to only 8 trade disputes, John, but basically the dispute settlement system in the WTO is pretty dysfunctional at the moment. It's been more or less non-operational. There's a parallel process running, but it's not the sort, it wasn't perhaps the environment with everything else going on in which you would likely have seen many formal disputes taken to the World Trade Organization, both because of distractions but also lost optimism about how they would proceed. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we're on a better track there. There's a new director general and things are beginning to move a little bit. I guess we've got a lot to see play out as China, if President's plans for much greater concentration on domestically generated growth, the sort of increased or changed weighting back to some of the state enterprises, the sort of mood still, I think, of sort of a more nationalistic mood across the developed world. And I suppose what troubles me more is what's happening in the developing world, where countries really didn't have the fiscal capacity to underwrite social supports or stimulus spending in the way advanced countries have, and then huge loss of social capital with vast unemployment mostly falling on the least well-off in already poor countries. Some kids not having been to school for 18 months now and not likely to get back for another 6 or more. So I think, you know, even in our own neighbourhood, we've got some bigger problems. It's hard to imagine that some of that won't play out in stress in developing economies that could find its way into debt problems and, you know, some of the sorts of difficulties we've seen in the past. But sorry to be the wet blanket here.
John, further on the globalisation question, a couple of weeks ago the Prime Minister made an announcement that Australia would invest $1 billion effectively building a guided weapons factory in Australia. And as part of the announcement, the Prime Minister said that one of the lessons of COVID was that we shouldn't be too dependent on foreign sources of key materials and resources, that in an emergency, the rules we rely on to guarantee the supplies of those key materials and resources will be set aside. Do you agree? Is that one of the lessons?
I mean, as a statement, it's really got nothing to do with the pandemic at all, has it? It could have been made at any point in the last half century and has often been made. But It's in a way rather telling of the underlying point that you can set up a guided weapons factory here, but you're nonetheless going to be dependent upon somebody else's technology to make your weapons effective. But plus it has nothing to do with pandemic, and the fact of the matter is that world trade has just has expanded in the second half of last year far more rapidly than GDP, and will continue to do so. That's basically the measure of globalization that people have been using for decades.
Mm. And Joe, I'm anxious just to, before I open it up to the audience, to quickly ask you about, and ask you both actually, about the outlook for developing countries in our region. You mentioned this in your introductory remarks. What most have managed the health effects reasonably well, although I noticed today the news from the Philippines and Malaysia looks less positive. The economic impact has been pretty hard, particularly on lower income groups. So I just wondered what the prospects are for Southeast Asia in the next year or so.
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably made the point I wanted to make on that. I think we could see much more difficult conditions in Southeast Asia, in India, in even in the Pacific, well, as we've seen in Papua New Guinea, the health side of the pandemic is still way far from under control. So how that plays through to growth rates and trade prospects and so on is another story. But I think, you know, there is a darker side to the optimistic idea we can't help but have in Australia, that we're over the worst of it, and with the vaccination process, things will get better. It's, I think, going to take quite a while.
Mm. And
but
John?
John have a more sophisticated view, I think, of how that's going to play through to the fundamentals.
Well, it's my sense is that Southeast Asia has handled it reasonably well. One of the results of this has been to reinforce the sense that East Asia generally is performing better than the rest of the world. You know, that despite the virus originating in China, we believe, the whole region has done comparatively well.
I see Andrew Lee has made his way up to the microphone, so you're more than welcome, Andrew. And I should say, Andrew, before you ask your questions, as having convened many of these kind of events over the years, inevitably you get more male hands going up than female. So I do encourage all the women in our audience to please ask their questions as well. But that's not to stop you at all, Andrew, so please go ahead.
Thanks, Sam. John, you're about the same age as Ross Garnaut, and your books seem to follow an interesting trajectory. 2013, he writes Dog Days. 2014, you write Beyond the Boom. Now this year, he's written Reset, and you've written the much more modestly titled Reconstruction. His diagnosis of the Australian economy is that there's deep-seated problems and there's need for big reforms. Yours is much more modest. So I suppose my question for you is, if John Curtin were Prime Minister today, would he really have finished his talk by saying it would be okay if we went back to where we were before the crisis?
Well, what I guess there's an underlying kind of tension between my view and Ross's about how well we'd done prior to 2019, and this is, as you suggest, is a repeat of the of an earlier disagreement we had from his Dog Days book, which came out at the same time as an earlier Lowy paper of mine on called, I think, Beyond the Boom. And Ross, as I recall, was saying at the time, which was 2008, 2009, that Australia was heading for what he described as the deepest recession since the Great Depression as a result of the terms of trade coming off and us our dependence upon mineral exports in the terms of trade. Well, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. Ross might well say, well, the terms of trade didn't come off quite the way I expected them to, and that saved us. But I don't think that's true. I think we discovered that, as I made a point in my book, actually our performance before and during the boom, the mining investment boom, was far more modest than people imagine. And accordingly, it wouldn't be hard to sustain growth and employment. And we did. We did. I guess the other point I'd make is, I think if the trope of advocating a change based on the idea that we had failed is quite unnecessary. You know, you can make an argument for, well, we'll need a universal basic income, or we will need to, power more of our industries with hydrogen, or we must take a look at our corporate tax system, without necessarily needing to say that our performance hitherto has been a shambles, because it hasn't been. It just hasn't. It's been good. But I do think that proposals for reform should stand independently of a notion that only by this reform can we recover the disaster we have become. That's what I think, Andrew.
Please, if you'd like to. Would you mind? Sure, we'll take both questions.
No, thank you, Sam. And not wanting to add to a parliamentary parade, but I'm Peter Kane, member for Ginninderra, recently elected to the ACT Legislative Assembly. So, John, thank you for your talk and for your manuscript as well. My theme is debt. Now, you said that the economic calamity is over. So my first question is, with generational-level debt, how could that be so? My second question is, how do you recommend the government manage the enormous debt we're currently carrying? And my third question is, what priority should be given to that?
Yeah, well, they're good. They're tough, good, tough questions. And I'd make a few points. One is that, weirdly, because interest rates are so much lower now, a government bond rate is so much lower now than it was prior to the pandemic, the actual interest cost of debt, despite the debt being so much greater today than it was before, the actual interest cost of debt has fallen as a share of GDP for the Australian government compared to, say, I think 2015-16. It's less. Well, you may say, well, that's just a temporary reprieve, that interest rates, government bond rates are not going to stay at somewhere between 1% and 2% forever. And when it rises, we're going to be in strife. And that may be so. But on the other hand, the nature of debt is such that the Australian Office of Financial Management has the opportunity not only to issue more additional debt at a very low rate, but to refinance its entire debt for 10 years at an extremely low rate and I assume is doing so. And this means that we can postpone the problem presented by a rising interest rate on a larger debt, probably for another, until the, you know, 2030s. By which time we may, if the normal rate of growth of the economy is around about 5, and as it highly likely will be, and if the government bond rate is well below 5, as it highly likely will be, debt will be, if it's, unless we're running stupendous deficits, debt will be less as a share of GDP than it is today. So that's our way out. That was the way, that was essentially the way we got out of the debts built up during World War II. It's the way we'll get out of this. But it will be a burden. I agree with that.
Thank you very much. Jenny Gordon, I'm with DFAT. I just want to, I love the global, the optimism, which is really good to have that. But as a policymaker, you really want to focus on all the things that might happen that we need to actually think about policies to make sure they don't happen. So I tend to always sort of be the glass half empty rather than the glass half full approach to things. And so I'm looking, thinking about, and I'd love to get your opinion on, the global risks that are still out there and, you know, the ones that we need to react to but can't necessarily manage. And in particular, you know, the massive build-up in, you know, unconventional monetary policy, financing, as you say, very high levels of debt, but also very high levels of stimulus that we've seen go into asset prices, question about fundamental value of assets and the scope for a potential financial crisis coming through. What might be the triggers for that? Turkey, Brazil are worrying. Big ones that fall over, seriously worrying. There's lots of little ones that are going to fall over. And we've already had 3 African countries look for debt restructuring under the DSSI. And so there are a lot of risks out there. And why it matters for Australia is because we export commodities and we're getting very good prices for a lot of our commodities. And that has what has done us so well. And so if Australia can't get that export gold effectively to buy our imports cheaply, our quality of life will really suffer. So I'm just wondering where you see those risks and how we should be thinking about trying to manage those. Thank you.
Yeah, well, the great issues again, Jenny, and but there are a number of different issues involved, I think. One is there... It's absolutely true that we've done it, the US has done it, Japan's been doing it for 20 years, the UK has done it. Europe generally has done it, that is, it's created money to buy government bonds. So there's been a big increase in money supply, money stock in the US, here, Europe. An issue is, does this lead to rampant inflation that Milton Friedman would say, you know, inflation is always and everywhere a money a monetary issue, a money issue, and there ought to be a relationship between an increase in the money stock and an increase in inflation, which would likely trigger central banks to follow very contractionary policies and plunge us into a global downturn. And what you can say of that is that there's no evidence whatsoever that it's occurring. That is, US inflation is just tracking along at 2%. There's no sign of inflation rising elsewhere. There was no sign of inflation rising when we last did this, which was 2008. The US, for example, went into a huge creation of money in 2008 with inflation running at 2.5%. And as a result of the 2008 recession, inflation fell right away, and subsequently, for most of the last decade, it's been running at around about 2. So it was running at a lower rate after the monetary expansion than it was before it. So it looks like Friedman was wrong. I mean, Friedman is a very bright guy. He would have changed his view by now were he alive. I don't think we're going to have a real big problem with the expansion of the money supply, the money stock, and it's interesting that the Fed, that if you look at the money stock figures and Fed buying of bonds, they're both sort of tapering off. That was mainly in the first 6 months of last year, and it's not so in the subsequent period. And I think that'll continue. And indeed, to the extent that the US does well, it will be able to, the Fed will be able to reduce its bond buying. This probably means we are going to face higher bond rates, but that option will be available to the Fed. As to what happens in Brazil, Turkey, their issues, aren't they, usually issues of to what extent it has US dollar debt. They have US dollar debt and they're troubled by depreciation of their own currencies. And I don't know enough about them, except that you can have a very big downturn in Turkey and a very big downturn in Brazil without it troubling us, or much troubling the rest of the world.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. That takes us to the end of our time today. Oh, I'm sorry. We've got time for one more. Yeah, why not? Let's take another question, please.
Dr. Irina Zaborcova, I've got two questions, actually, if possible. Firstly, what are your views on the housing price situation in Australia? And second, I'd like to broaden the question of technology. To what extent do you think the current pandemic might influence Australia's role in the fourth industrial revolution, because we've been behind the leading countries in this?
John, it's not an economic conversation in Australia without someone asking about housing prices.
Yes, well, I mean, you know, for young people, house price increase is just a huge challenge. It changes the nature of our society and where we're going. And it's very largely a distributive question. We're not, for example, building a lot more homes than we need. So we're not threatening a collapse of the housing industry. On the contrary, we don't seem to be building enough. The expansion of debt that goes along with high house prices and home ownership is certainly there, but rates are so low that the share of disposable income that the entire Australian population is paying on mortgage debt is lower now, lower than it was probably for 10 years, despite huge expansion of debt. So it's more of a distributive problem. It's very hard on young people. But it's not, at this point, actually threatening our financial stability or threatening the real economy, I don't think. Your second question I didn't hear very well.
Well,
I think that's too big a question for this part of the evening.
Yeah. Look, I'm really sorry, but the Press Club have asked us to wrap up, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to do that now. I should say that there are, if anyone would like an additional copy of the book, we do have them available if you'd like to purchase one. Also, John is happy to sign a copy of the book if you'd like to do that. And so all that's left for me to do really is for is to ask you to thank John Edwards and Joanna Hewitt. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.